Thanks a lot for hosting me here. I am super excited to be here, but I haven't slept all that well last night, so if you see me yawning during the talk, it's not you. Okay, so this afternoon I wanted to share with you some fun investigations and amusing lessons that I learned over the course of the last year completed and ongoing projects with and without fantastic collaborators, one of whom all of you in this room should instantly recognize, right? Okay, so where are we now? We found the Higgs. Not long after the LHC turned on, it scripted a success story, as you all know. But ever since, in spite of systematically ramping up collider energies and luminosities, we basically found nothing, right? This is a glimpse of the null results of searches for well-motivated scenarios of new physics. From the latest round of searches, okay? And what you see immediately here, what is the most obvious thing that you see here is that it's a sweeping hunt, right? so there's so many channels that we've been looking for new physics, and with so many search techniques that it's actually hard to keep track, right? And as if that was not enough, well-meaning phenomenologists are pushing for looking for motivated new physics in all combinations of standard model final states, okay? And they managed to specify the quantum numbers of new particles that you could find in these combinations, right? But in spite of this the width of this array of searches, the one common unifying theme, underlying theme, in all these searches is that if you want to find new principles of physics at colliders, you do it by making particles, right? Now that's at least how searches are, that's how at least you base your searches for most searches for new physics, right? Now this line of thought has led to a certain sequence, okay, of how we expect new physics to come to us through colliders, and that sequence goes like this. We first try to look for some sort of a resonance, some sort of a kinematic bump in some kinematic spectrum, like the invariant mass, right? And the location of your peak in this spectrum gives you information about the mass of the new particle that you're producing. And if you're lucky enough, you could resolve the width of this new particle, and then after you catch this particle, you go to the corresponding angular spectra at that particular energy and sift through all the angular information that you have so that you can disentangle further information about the underlying physics, like spins and couplings and so on, right? Now that's how this is a sequence in which we actually understood the Higgs. We first found the Higgs in the invariant mass spectrum of diphotons, and then later we combined different channels, and then to actually make sure that we have the standard model of Higgs, we looked through the angular spectra of four lepton final states, and we were able to tell to some extent that the Higgs CP properties corresponded to the standard model, right? And this is how we try to look for new physics in for example, Z prime resonances too, like these authors have detailed, right? However, there is a danger in this sequence, okay? Which is by making kinematic spectra super prominent, first of all, a lot of experiments have relegated angular spectra as an afterthought, and in many cases it's not even measured, okay? So it's natural to ask, is there any reason to believe in the reverse sequence? Can we expect to actually, are there any natural models where you can expect to see new physics in angular spectra first before we go and get some information from the kinematic spectra? Okay. And if I really want to be cheeky, I can go all the way back to prehistory and tell you that the first successful quantum model of the atom didn't come to us through kinematic spectra. There was some information from spectral emissions, and Rydberg was able to work out empirical formulae to explain these emissions, but without any knowledge of the underlying model behind it. And until Rutherford scattered alpha particles against gold foils and used the angular spectra to actually give us a good model of the nucleus, we didn't have a good handle of what the atom was. It's the Rydberg model that eventually led to the Bohr model that successfully explained the Rydberg formula. Sorry, it's the Rutherford model that led to the Bohr model that successfully explained the Rydberg formula, right? But coming closer to colliders, even the Z boson didn't show up in our colliders by us making it, okay? Long before we had the kinematic, the energy required to produce the Z-on shell, in the late 1970s, electron-positron machines running at energies much below the Z-mass were still able to see glimpses of this new physics through interference effects in angular spectra, right? Because the Z-boson violates parity, so the imprint of it can be measured in forward-backward asymmetry measurements. And by studying the shape of this spectra carefully, they were able to set a very good bound on the Z mass, close to the actual mass, right? And then only years later did Carlo Rubbia commission the superproton synchrotron to run proton-antiproton collisions at energies above the Z mass, and they were able to see the characteristic signal of the Breitwiedner peak of the Z boson, right? And then again, after we caught the Z boson this way, more colliders were built, and angular spectra of these Z bosons were studied even more carefully, and then we were actually able to confirm that we did catch the standard model Z boson with the correct spins and chiral couplings, right? Now, at the LHC, what do we expect? At the LHC, there is actually no guarantee that new physics has to be resonant, right? That is, all you're looking for is modifications to matrix elements of the processes that you're measuring. And that modification need not give you a nice Breitwiedner resonance, right? So if those modifications are not giving you resonance features, you're not sure where to look for these particles first. You're not sure that you actually want to look for them in the kinematic spectrum first. And there's no reason to pick one over the other, right? Then, yes.
You left out the slight discovery of Koch.
Is that also angular spectra? Yes. Deep inelastic scattering? Yes. Yes, okay, yes. Right, right. Perfect, yeah. So, in this scenario then, what you would actually want to do, the sensible thing to do, would be to study all spectra at once and then use every piece of information that you can get to extract all at once all the quantum properties like mass, spins, couplings, and so on, right? And again, in this scenario, then there is a very real possibility that the place where you're going to see new physics first is in the angular spectra. Okay, that makes it super important for experimentalists to measure the angular spectra side by side with kinematic spectra. So what do I mean by non-resonant new physics? Two simple realizations that I could think of is to complete that blob with a T-channel exchange, for instance, that's not going to give you a nice Breitwiedner feature. Or I could complete it with radiative corrections to the amplitude. Again, it's not trivial how the signals are going to look like if I have these effects, right? And in this talk, we're going to deal only with these diagrams. What we're going to see is that a simple resonant, non-resonant completion could be coming from leptoquarks, and we'll see how the LHC can probe leptoquarks this way. Dark matter. And if I have time, I'll also talk about how you could use scattering angles to probe the Higgs-Yukawa couplings to light quarks. Okay. So if I now want to go down this line of thought, I would like to choose a lamppost for that, and in this shape of the energy frontier, which is basically the cross sections of all standard model processes. What I would do is to pick the simplest case, which is the left end of the plot, basically electroweak production, because that's where you can see interference effects best, just because these processes have very good cross sections and are small on the errors. Okay. In particular, for my study, I'm going to choose the Drellian process, basically quark anti-quark in the initial state and lepton anti-lepton in the final state, which is a channel that has historically given us a lot of Nobel Prizes. Again, just because they have well understood clean backgrounds, very well reconstructable particles in the final state. Okay, and that's supposed to be the biggest Feynman diagram on Earth, inscribed on the atrium of University of Oregon, where I graduated. And this was commissioned in the 1970s, and we're going to find that it's still a very relevant channel for us to look for new physics, just because it has these very nice features. When we talk about angular spectra, it's not the entire spectrum itself that people usually talk about, but a spectrum characterizing observable called the forward-backward asymmetry. Whenever you see angular spectra, this is the proxy that people talk about to study, right? So let's first try to understand what we mean by the forward-backward asymmetry. Okay. So the angle that we are concerned with in this process is the angle between the outgoing fermions and the incoming fermions in the center of momentum frame. Okay. And if I plot the spectrum of this angle at energies that are really low compared to the Z mass, then it's going to look symmetric like this, right, across theta of zero. And that's because quantum electrodynamics does not violate parity, so you should expect a nice symmetric angular spectrum. Now, the forward-backward asymmetry is nothing but the area under the curve on the positive side of cos theta, which correspond to forward events, minus the area on the negative side of cos theta, which corresponds to the backward events in the scattering, and then basically normalized to the total number of events. Okay, so if I plot that for a snapshot at 10 GeV in center of mass energy, it's gonna be zero basically, right? But as I ramp up the energy a little bit, the spectrum becomes lopsided, and clearly it's asymmetric. And in this case, interference effects from the Z violate parity, that puts an imprint on the spectrum, and at this energy you end up with a negative forward-backward asymmetry. Okay, and this is what Petra measured in the late 1970s to put a bound on the Z mass. As I ramp up the energy a little more, funnier interference effects start happening because of the unique chiral couplings of the Z boson in the Shannon model. It looks like the spectrum has come back to its symmetric state, but that's a false alarm because as you ramp up the energy even more, more interference effects kick in, and then the spectrum basically freezes to that shape. Okay, so resulting in a constant forward-backward asymmetry much above the Z mass, which is where searches are ongoing right now. Okay, now the story is not this simple when we are dealing with the LHC. because you would notice that when I crash electrons and anti-electrons, I know where the electron is coming from and I know where the anti-electron is coming from. So I know whether my scattering angle is, I can actually exactly reconstruct my scattering angle, right? But if I'm crashing proton antiprotons, I can no longer afford the luxury of that knowledge, right? In fact, there are four subtleties going on here. The first is, as I said, I don't know where the quark comes from and I don't know where the antiquark comes from. So I don't know whether my scattering angle is theta or 180 minus theta. The second is, because protons are bags of partons, there's always an uncertainty on the transverse momenta of the partons inside the proton. So I actually don't know what the B maxes of the quark antiquark is. Right, so there is some uncertainty on that. This applies to any collider, but especially at the LHC, producing jets are cheap because it's a color collider. So I'm going to have a huge effect from initial state radiations of jets, right? And finally, again, this is universal to all colliders, and especially at the LHC, there's always some error from detector resolution to on telling what your rapidity is. Okay.
So the third one is, if you don't measure your ISR accurately enough, then you can't basically reconstruct what the actual scattering angle is, because you aren't aware of the other moment contributions to the state.
Right. It comes to that, exactly. Yeah. Basically, if you can't measure this well enough, you can't measure the invariant mass well enough, so you don't know what bin to put it in. So, okay. But you can get around some of these limitations, okay, by simply, if you're going to look for new physics at really high center of mass energies, and if you can integrate many events in large bins, then you can get around these three at least. And the first two limitations can also be gotten around by doing something clever that was proposed by Collins and Soper way back in the 1970s. Basically, to actually tell the scattering angle, what you would want to do is go to the center of momentum frame of the final states of the L plus L minus, and the direction in which you boost is most likely the direction in which the quark originated, right? So you just assign that as the direction of the quark. So with this assumption, you can reconstruct a scattering angle, and you can use it as a consistent definition of your scattering angle.
So
you
say the quark, that's as opposed to the anti-quark.
Exactly. Because it's a, yeah, in a proton, the quark parton distributions are higher than an anti-quark. Okay, so all that information is encoded in the parton distribution functions. And it's a completely reproducible scattering angle, which you can work with to construct a spectrum. Right? Okay, now there's a lot of algebra going on here, but what this all boils down to is simply this. At high invariant masses, what you want to do to tell whether an event is forward or backward is this. In the rapidity axis, look for where the lepton falls as opposed to the anti-lepton. Construct a double cone around it, okay, in eta space. If your anti-lepton now falls inside the double cone, that event is a forward event. This is all it comes down to geometrically. If it falls outside, it's a backward event. Okay. So what you see is that this is exactly what people also call the charge asymmetry. It's just that they don't write this in experimental papers, but it is identical to the charge asymmetry measured for say top anti-top angular asymmetries, for instance. Okay, so now there is one other effect that this funny reconstruction does, which is to dilute all your asymmetries, especially the forward backward asymmetry. That's, and which you can see clearly by plotting the spectrum with truth level information, and the Collins-Hopper reconstruction. Okay, the dotted, the dashed line I've drawn here is at the center of momentum frame that I calculated by hand, but with that which you cannot reconstruct at the LHC, and that's what the solid line is what you can actually reconstruct at the LHC. Clearly, less forward events and more backward events because of this assumption that the quark comes from the direction of the boost, right? That should dilute some of your asymmetry, which again I have plotted over here. The solid line here is what I would get if I actually do the calculation in the center of momentum frame. This is data from CMS that clearly shows a dilution. But again, as I ramp up the energy, this dilution should go away, because the more and more energetic my final states are, the assumption that the quark came from the direction of the boost becomes truer and truer, right? So as I ramp up the energy even more, I'm getting more and more alignment, and the dilution basically goes away. So that's the physics behind forward backward asymmetry, and that's the beast we're going to deal with, okay? Now at the LHC, for dileptons, there have been measurements of the Collins-Hopper frame scattering angle, which have been turned into forward backward asymmetry measurements. Except that if you actually go through the INSPIRE literature, there's no phenomenologist, no theorist that has cited these papers. Nobody has taken this data seriously. Nobody has tried to recast this into new physics models. Okay, so now you could ask, I have this data lying around. Maybe the best thing you could find with this data is non-resonant new physics. Can I construct some model that can constrain or have sensitivity with this data? Okay. Okay. Then the simplest non-resonance that I can construct is to add an amplitude to the standard model that has a T-channel exchange, right? And the moment I write this down, I see that the angular spectrum that I should get is completely different from the S-channel exchange of a vector from the standard model, right? That means there should be some sensitivity the data should give you to this scenario. And the T-channel completion that I've given here is nothing but what is called a leptoquark. A leptoquark is a scalar or a vector that couples to a quark and a lepton through renormalizable operators. Okay, that's the simplest explanation, the simplest description you can give of a leptoquark. So that's the question that we can pose. You have qualitatively different spectra once you add this leptoquark. Can the forward-backward asymmetry measurements already say something about this? Yes, yes.
For instance, in this example, is it clear that the forward-backward asymmetry is the best observable to look at? Because it's really different spectrum, so why?
Right.
Why
so,
directly for?
Good. So I'll come to that. So there's actually nicer ways to probe leptoquark than just the forward-backward asymmetry.
Right.
Yeah. In fact, I actually deleted some slides, but I just want to say this. I think the forward-backward asymmetry is an obsolete observable in the LHC era. It helped us to find parity violating stuff long back, like the Z boson and other things. But now, with all this difficulty about reconstructing the Collins-Hopper frame and all that, it would be much nicer to use variables that are Lorentz invariant, so that I don't have to be in a special frame. I can do my calculations in the center of momentum frame, and maybe vanishing. So you can construct nice variables having these properties.
So yes. Really surprised. Yeah. You've constructed better ways to look.
Yeah. But I've not put them in my slide, so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but.
You say non-resonance. Presumably, a leptic quark is a particle.
Correct. Sorry, say that again?
The leptic quark would be a particle.
Yes.
So why does it have a resonance?
Yes, so we'll come to that in two slides, yes. There are resonant searches, but I'll show you that searching for leptoquarks this way gives you much better sensitivities. And I'll tell you why also in a couple of minutes.
By the way,
yes.
you never see free quotes.
Mm-hmm.
They were discovered by Robert Piscator, Slack. So
yep.
then a form of dark matter.
That's true. Okay. Cool. So since we have not gotten into this business of the leptoquark, let's try to understand what is a leptoquark. Okay. I bet that nobody in this room has worked on leptoquarks. it was hot once upon a time, but it's now become this neglected child of particle physics because it doesn't seem to give you ready solutions to current problems. Okay. There are lots of motivations for the existence of leptoquarks. Some of the usual ones given are that these always invariably appear as low energy remnants of grand unified theories. You will usually have them in technicolor and composite theories. They occur naturally in R parity violating supersymmetry in the LQD operator. Recently, people have been exploring leptoquarks as viable dark matter strand model mediators. And every time there's a low energy flavor anomaly like the RK anomaly, somebody writes down a leptoquark explanation for it. Okay, but the motivation that I loved the most is in a paper by Raman Sundaram and Gian Giudici. They say that if you just want to use the LHC as a lamppost to look for new physics at the TEV scale and forget about all theoretical biases, then one of the first places you want to look for is new physics that couples to Strand model fermions through renormalizable operators. Okay. Then if you start going down that avenue, there's actually not many possibilities that you can write down. There's like diquarks, dileptons, Suzy-like dark matter that couples two quarks and leptons through a mediator, and there's leptoquarks. Okay, this is something that we could actually discover at the LHC with forthcoming data. Okay, so that's motivation enough for me. Now, to do an illustrative study. I want to choose a leptoquark model. There's tons of, not tons, there are like 12 leptoquark models that you can write down depending on the spin and the quantum numbers. To make my life easy, I'm choosing a couple of leptoquark species that do not violate baryon number. So these are the two species that do that. And I also choose a flavor structure such that my leptoquark couples only to an up quark and an electron, or an up quark and a muon, or an up quark and a down quark, a down quark and an electron, and a down quark and a muon. And I call them by these names based on the prefixes and suffixes of leptoquark.
Is that where you work out of leptoquark models that does violate baryon numbers that isn't just completely excluded by proton decay constraints?
There are those models that...
Oh, there are constructions for these.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Usually you would require these leptoquark models to have small couplings or large masses to avoid those constraints, and those are generally not so good for probing at the LHC. That's another reason why. Yeah. Okay. So that brings me to this very simplified space of parameters where I would probe only the renormalizable Yukawa coupling of the leptoquark and the mass of the leptoquark. Okay. This is where we're going to do our phenomenology. And for illustration, I'm going to choose a leptoquark that couples to an electron and an up quark. Okay, that's one of the most visible leptoquarks you could find at the LHC. Okay, so as he pointed out, leptoquarks are particles. You would produce them as resonances, and that's how the LHC experiments are looking for them. So the existing strategy to look for leptoquarks is to produce them this way, directly through QCD, okay? And then with suitable branching ratios, you let them decay to quarks and leptons so that after you pair produce them, the signature that you look for is a couple of jets and a couple of leptons of opposite signs. Yes?
Can you
quarks are confined.
Yeah.
That's why you don't see it directly. So why lambda quarks could be confined? It's a kind of quark.
I wouldn't say it's a kind of.
Why not?
Unless there are strong dynamics, there's no reason for them to be confined, right? They just need to carry color, but that doesn't mean they have to be confined.
That's an assumption.
Like, well, would you say that quarks are confined?
Yes.
No.
Top quark.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Yeah. Exactly. The top quark and the bottom quark also.
You don't see quarks.
If they're above the confinement scale.
You don't see them in direct patronization of that.
Sure. Cool. So because the search proceeds, the production proceeds mainly through QCD, the kind of constraints that you get, I'm not sure if you can see the colors here, but it's supposed to be light brown. Basically, the constraints that you get basically look like this. Right now, with 8 TV data, for reasonably small leptoquark couplings, leptoquarks below around a TV are already ruled out. Okay, but then as I crank up the coupling, the channel that the amplitude that actually involves the renormalizable Yukawa coupling becomes important, so you get this slight extra sensitivity at high couplings. But there's a second way in which at least CMS looks for leptoquarks, which they also call a direct search, which is to produce these leptoquarks singly. Okay, but it's not all single production. There are only a couple of diagrams that actually produce these leptoquarks on shell. In most cases, the leptoquark basically mediates the process. But in any case, the signature with which they look for these particles is through a pair of leptons of opposite signs and a jet. Okay, and notice that this process cannot happen if the coupling is the Yukawa coupling is zero. Right, so. It's completely sensitive to the coupling. And so as you crank up the mass, you need higher and higher couplings to probe it. Yes? So this particular flavor structure that I chose, even if I set this flavor structure at the Planck scale and then I run everything down, there's very little FCNCs. Because
so
it's all it.
Like that in such a way.
No, the coupling. Well, that's true actually. The coupling matrix that I chose is basically this, right? I'm coupling only to up and electron, and then you'll see that the RG evolution depends on the light quark Yukawas, and their loop suppressed, so they actually don't. Give you FCNCs.
But this is not, what symmetry imposes this?
There's no symmetry as such. It's a.
So it's you pick main one flavor violating because of data.
Right.
Otherwise,
right.
If you want to put
generic, yeah, there should be flavor violation immediately, yes.
Yeah,
that's absolutely true, yes. Yes, and I don't know if this is a good answer, but I didn't choose this coupling. This is something that's fashionable, and yeah. Okay, so the constraint that I should get from single production is should basically depend on the coupling as well as the mass, and that's the shape that you get from the constraint, right? But if I were to look for leptoquarks in the dileptron spectrum, okay, which is not what experiments do right now, then I should get something like this. This is how the background looks like. The dominant background, at least, through an S-channel mediation of electroweak bosons, which is basically up far above the Z-peak, a smoothly falling 1 over S shape. But the moment I put in an extra amplitude with T-channel exchange, interference effects start kicking in, right? So here I've drawn the signal for various masses and couplings of the leptoquark. the solid lines are when I fix the mass to a TEV and then move the coupling around. And obviously, if I crank up the coupling, the effect, the rate, the signal rates go up. The black lines are when I fix the coupling to one and move the masses around, right? For lower masses, interference effects start kicking in earlier. For higher masses, they kick in later, but eventually they all asymptote to a certain value, a certain rate, right? So I can use these features to recast existing LHC dileptron data into these parameters. And what I get by doing a shape fit is basically this, the red line, okay? So it, you can see that it's already doing better than the single production of leptoquarks. And I was not the first person to turn invariant masses into a constraint, dileptron invariant masses. Mark Weiss and Yui Zhang also did it, but then they were looking at bins where there were high mass bins where there were no events. They were using Poisson statistics, but I basically took all the bins and did Gaussian statistics, so I'm getting slightly better bounds. But nevertheless, the point is that by looking at dileptron final states, which are clean, reconstructable, very well measured, you already get better constraints than single production, which, if you remember, has a jet in it. So jet dirties the final state and makes things a little less sensitive. Okay? But there's more. There's also, as I said, the angular spectrum, right? Because, this is how the background looks like to begin with. You have this lopsided spectrum with a positive forward backward asymmetry at high invariant masses. But as I when I put in the T-channel exchange, I get even more dramatic signal spectra. Right? It's not clear at all what kind of forward backward asymmetry or what I can even what kind of variable I should construct to study these. Right? Again, moving the masses and couplings really changes things around qualitatively. And if I take a snapshot of the angular spectrum at a different invariant mass, things move around again. Okay? So again, one simple way to characterize this is to plot them as forward-backward asymmetries, and I get really crazy signals. The forward-backward asymmetry can go negative, can come back to positive, and so on. So I can recast these features into limits, again by doing appropriate shape fits, and what I get is something like this. Comparable to the invariant mass spectrum is what I get as my constraint. And in this case, it so happens to be slightly better than the invariant mass spectrum, right? So this, I hope, is already proof of principle that angular spectra non-resonant channels can give you much better sensitivities than resonant spectra of channels that are slightly more difficult to measure. Okay? Now, if I had ended the story here, if I had ended the story here, it would have been sweet already, but yes.
You're using this A and B instead of just picking the shape of the spectrum.
I could have done the cosine theta shape.
Right.
The only reason I didn't do that was that the secondary backgrounds in the cosine theta shape become important at high rapidities. And I didn't know how to model them. So I just wanted to show that the forward-backward asymmetry already does better than everything else. But yeah, if I did everything more carefully, I should get even slightly more better constraints. But yes. So now at colliders, I would say that angular spectra of dileptrons should give you the best constraints on leptoquark couplings. Except it so happens that many, many years ago in Boulder, Colorado, there's this measurement of atomic parity violation at the extreme precision of 0.35%. That that should be sensitive to leptoquarks because most leptoquarks have chiral couplings that you can write down as effective operators at low energy and extract the weak nuclear charge, okay, which you can turn into bounds on the couplings versus mass. And just because of this high precision, the bound that you get from atomic parity violation actually swarms over all the collided bounds. And this is a piece of information that is totally not appreciated in leptoquark literature, at least since starting from the 2000s. Okay, and especially if you read through the CMS and Atlas papers on leptoquark searches, they repeatedly keep saying, we set the best bounds to date on leptoquark couplings and masses. Not true. Atomic parity violation at low energy has already set much better bounds, at least if leptoquarks couple to electrons. Okay. Of course, you could get around it if leptoquarks coupled to muons, because as Maxim Pospelov could tell you, we have basically zero bounds from atomic parity, muonic atomic parity violation. Right? There's no parity violation experiments done in muonic systems. The story holds true. If I couple to down quarks also, I get some reduced sensitivities because down quark parton densities are smaller in protons. But otherwise, qualitatively, all the results should still hold true. Okay, so how do things change in the future then? Okay, in particular, I got interested in the question of can the LHC ever beat the atomic parity violation bound? Okay, although the LHC is a hadron collider, supposed to be dirtier, with enough statistics, can you ever achieve enough statistical precision to beat the precision of low energy measurements? Okay, and it turns out the answer is yes, by a long distance. At 300 inverse femtobarn, if I'm coupling to up quarks, both the invariant mass and the angular spectrum should give you much better sensitivities than the atomic parity violation. Of course, you could ask, what about the atomic parity violation? Are they getting any better? It turns out the design precision, even for experiments 10 years from now, doesn't go better than like 0.2%. So that's not going to move much. But the LHC can go farther than the precision of these experiments. Okay? And if I couple to down quarks, I'm down by PDFs. But it so happens that the angular spectra lead the way. And so in this particular case with 300 inverse femtobarn of luminosity, what cannot be caught by invariant masses can actually be caught by angular spectra. Okay. There's also more cool things that you could do by studying angular spectra. For instance, just like you could tell the spin and chirality of the Z boson, you could actually tell the spin of leptoquarks, which I've illustrated with a normalized spectrum for some benchmark point with the full spectrum. And if I characterize it as a forward backward asymmetry, you could see some qualitative difference between spin 0 and spin 1 leptoquarks. And in particular, with this observable, which is sometimes called the center edge asymmetry, basically looking at all the central events and the edge events, choosing the populations of events such that the standard model asymmetry goes to 0, you could clearly mark out spin 0 and spin 1 from their different signs, right? So cool, there's all sorts of fun you could have once you delve into angular spectra. So much for leptoquarks. Now let's see how angular spectra can help us look for yet another well-motivated new physics scenario, dark matter. Okay, so broadly speaking, how do you look for particle dark matter? You break it, or you shake it, or you make it, right? When we think of dark matter at colliders, this is the orientation of the diagram that we usually think about. How much time do I have left? Okay, cool. In particular, when we whether the mediator of between dark matter and the Shannon model is heavy enough that it is kinematically accessible, or whether you can actually produce it at a collider, the end signature, the characteristic signature that we think of when we want to look for dark matter at colliders is missing transverse energy, right? But is missing transverse energy the only inevitable effect that dark matter would have at colliders? Okay, and to answer that question, let's remind ourselves of the Z boson story again. We first saw the Z boson not by actually producing it, not through its characteristic bright Wigner signal, but through interference effects, right? So take it from me that any new physics model will always have interference effects in various channels, okay? Whether you can find those interference effects or not is a different matter altogether, but in principle, there should always be interference effects. Even if I take the cartoon diagram, I can flip it and join them together and I get channel model final states back, right? Proof of principle, these authors showed that at LEP, radiative corrections coming from leptophilic dark matter models should give you, through effective operators, should give you sensitivities better than direct monophoton searches at LEP. Okay? Now, at the LHC, could you then actually find dark matter through interference effects? Could they actually complement missing transverse signals? And whether they do or not, by studying these interference effects, can we actually start telling the character of dark matter, like its spin, mass, chirality of couplings, and so on? Okay? Okay, so to find out, let's write down a simplified model. There's a busy Lagrangian, but all I wanted to point out here is that there's a simplified model with fermionic dark matter that couples to both quarks and leptons through scalar mediators. And to make life easier, I'm going to choose the couplings to be the couplings to both the quarks and the leptons to be the same, and I'm going to choose the mediators to be degenerate, just to study what happens if I have the scenario. Okay. Now, the moment I write down this simplified model, loop corrections are inevitable. Okay, so I should have self energy corrections, vertex corrections, and box corrections, and so on. Now, again, instead of putting together all these amplitudes, I could make my life easier if I confine myself to regions where the new physics coupling is roughly greater than one. Okay, that seems to be the generic feature of these simplified models if I want to get successful freeze-out. And also, if I want to detect them through even direct production of mediators, as these authors pointed out, that's the region where the LHC has sensitivity.
Okay.
Yes. Sorry.
Yeah. How do you know this object is the dark matter from Western physics?
We'll see.
Because it could be a neutral.
Yeah. So this, right. This
could be stable.
I agree. So you could impose some sort of stability by assuming a Z2 symmetry under which these new particles are odd and the Shannon model is even.
Has to be a stable part.
Yeah. So you would want to impose the stability, yes, by hand.
How do you figure this out experimentally?
Whether it is stable or not, at colliders, you cannot. At collider length scales, you can only tell whether it's stable up to the detector.
You're picking up some neutral particle.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, if you really want to nail it down as dark matter, it's not just through colliders. You would have to look for it in other experiments too, direct detection in other experiments. Yes.
That's a unfortunate disadvantage.
not really.
You haven't seen it yet.
Right.
Okay, so question. Yeah. You're saying that this strong coupling limit is already motivated because you're going to higher and higher mass scales,
right?
And this means that you need a larger and larger analytical cross section.
Sure, exactly. That's exactly. Yeah. Or even if you think of just, even if you don't think of it as dark matter and just look for collider stable particles through mediators, and you, as we ramp up the energy, you would want to, you are going to higher and higher couplings. So to make life simpler, I'm choosing that, and what you see immediately is that the box diagrams go as four powers of the coupling in the amplitude, whereas the other diagrams go as at least two powers of the electrovic coupling. Okay, so you would, when you do the calculation, you find that the contribution of the box diagrams totally swamps over the other contributions. Okay, so let's just concentrate on what boxes do. Okay, so what do box diagrams do? There's something neat happening about them, because if I pump in enough energy in the initial state, I can make these particles in the horizontal lines go on shell, right? And when that happens, the amplitude should develop an imaginary part through the optical theorem, right? And that imaginary part is given by the product of the two halves of the amplitude integrated over some phase space, right? And this is exactly what we see when we think of Bright-Wigner resonances. The self-energy correction develops an imaginary part that's given by half the amplitude squared. Basically, that's the width. And that's how you get these nice Bright-Wigner resonances from which you can catch the width, right? But with boxes, what you get is not a resonance, but what we call by this dumb name, geological name of monocline, okay? To answer your question, notice that this feature is not just for dark matter. Any new physics coupling, new physics scenario that gives you loop corrections should give you this effect, this threshold effect, okay? And also notice that there's three features that you could see in this illustrative plot that I've drawn for a dark matter mass of 500 GeV degenerate with mediators, okay? The first thing I would notice when I scan from left to right is that there is a gentle rise before I hit some interesting region, right? And that gentle rise can be characterized as a contact operator if I integrate out the masses, integrate out the particles in the loop. And then I hit this little region where there's a rapid rise coming from the imaginary part opening up, imaginary part of the amplitude opening up, and that rapid rise already gives me information on dark matter mass scales, because that happens at twice the mass of dark matter, right? And then as I go higher up in energies, unlike a Bright-Wigner resonance that comes back down to the background, what I have is a constant offset of rates. My rates now stand up, okay? And that's because beyond that point, the imaginary part of the amplitude dominates, and that now behaves like a heat channel, just like in the Lipkin case. Now, obviously, this is an optimistic case with a large coupling. So if I reduce my couplings, my signal should go away a little bit. If my mediators are heavier, again, there should be kinematic suppression in the loops, and the signal should be suppressed again, right? Now I can turn all these features into constraints, and this is how they look. In the top plot, I've drawn constraints in the coupling versus dark matter mass plane for a spectrum where the mediator is 50% away from dark matter. Now that's a busy plot, but I would like you to concentrate on the blue and the magenta lines. The magenta line is recasting searches, direct searches of the mediator from jet space net. Okay? And the blue lines are through these interference effects in dileptons. And clearly the blue lines do better than the direct searches at reasonably heavy dark matter masses, right?
But
of course.
But does it depend on the ratio between M5 and phi here? There's no, what if you start making M5 infinite?
Yeah, so as I peel M5 away to heavier masses, the dileptron rate should go down. And that's exactly where jet space might start doing better, because they have better missing energy acceptances. So what this tells you is that precisely where jet space might starts losing sensitivity is where interference effects start kicking in better. Okay, so this demonstrates that looking for dark matter this way clearly complements MET-based searches, missing energy-based searches. Okay?
Saying
yeah.
The mass of the dark matter was a factor two or so of the mass of the mediator, you're often going to be better at these searches.
Yeah, less than two or so. Yeah, exactly. In compressed spectra, you're going to do better with dielectron searches. And dielectrons is one example, but generally interference effects should give you. Okay, again, that's all in the invariant mass spectrum. Now we've started investigating what would happen if you are looking for these interference effects in the angular spectrum, because all you've done is modify the matrix element, right? And if our preliminary calculations are right, we find that constraints from the angular spectra rival or even slightly are better than the invariant mass spectrum constraints. Okay, so that means if you're going to see dark matter this way, you're going to first hit it in the, you might hit it in the angular spectrum, and that also means that since I have information about almost the entire matrix element through both pieces of information, the complementary pieces of information, I could use the spectral features to trace back the actual quantum properties of dark matter and mediators. Like I could use these features to tell, to start telling the spin and the self-conjugation property of dark matter and the chirality of their interactions and so on. Okay, so let me give you an example of that with one of the clearest places where you can tell this. Okay, so on the left, I've drawn the monocline signature in invariant mass spectra for both scalar and fermion dark matter, with the solid lines indicating the case where dark matter couples to right-handed quarks and right-handed leptons. And the dashed lines are when dark matter couples to right-handed quarks and left-handed leptons. Okay, and what you can see is that it's not so obvious that you can tell between the two cases of two chirality cases from the invariant mass spectrum, especially if you look at the scalar dark matter case, right? But if I see the features in the angular spectra, I clearly can tell the difference between the two chiralities, right? This is how we found the chiral couplings of the Z boson, for instance. I can make things slightly easier by turning them into forward backward asymmetries or taking the central fraction of events, which should clearly demarcate between the two chirality possibilities. Right? So you can make a flow chart that starts telling you the properties once you see signals.
For these
yes.
models,
yes.
without coupling to electrons, it's called atomic clarity violation, beat these constraints again.
Say that again?
If you have a coupling
yeah.
to electrons,
yes.
it's atomic parity violation, beat these constraints again.
So with, no, I mean, yeah. I mean, there in principle, there should be some effect, but then totally insensitive. Because over here, the effect that you get is from threshold effects at colliders. But at parity violation, because you have these boxes, there's loop suppression and so on. So.
Okay, so the loop suppression kills it.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. At parity violation, yes. Okay, do I have time for the third
yeah,
part of the talk? Okay, cool, okay, really quick. So that's the dark matter story. Let's see how scattering angles can help us find the Higgs, or help us nail down the Higgs. We have the Higgs, but we don't know how it couples to Stand model fermions. In particular, we have no direct probes on the couplings to up, down, strange, and charm. And there's this amazing hunt going on from the phenomenology community with cleverer and cleverer ideas on how to nail down the Higgs couplings at the LHC. And the name of the game here is that the best sensitivity you can get to these couplings is at the size of bottom quark you cover. If the new physics couplings are as big as the bottom quark you cover, then there is a chance that you can find it there. You can find it at the LHC using various clever techniques. Okay, so that got me thinking about scattering angles again. Now that I have this hammer, everything looks to me like a nail. So In particular, in the standard model, the Higgs-Dahlum process, the Higgs and vector boson production, usually proceeds through this. But then, in principle, you also have these T-channel diagrams, except they're totally subdued in the standard model, with standard model U covers. But if you crank up the couplings, these should also become important. And that should affect the angular spectra, right? So these are super preliminary plots. So take it with a grain of salt. If I crank the couplings up and down and plot just the rapidities, for instance, you don't see any changes in the spectra, right? But if I take the difference in the rapidity, which is a proxy for the scattering angle at high momenta, then there is clearly a change in the spectrum as I move the coupling around, right? In particular, because I have T-channel amplitudes becoming more and more important, I'm going to make events more and more central, right? Sorry, I'm going to make events more and more forward, actually. This is wrong. Now, do I have sensitivity at the LHC? I can make a quick back of the envelope calculation by turning this around into an edge center asymmetry. And what I find is that for up and down quarks at the size of a bottom quark U cover, if I plug in, first of all, I find that there is like a percent level deviation at the bottom quark U cover level. And then if I actually find the number of events that I would produce at 300 inverse femtobond, you find that you do have at least statistical sensitivity to this. So there is something that you could, there is stuff to do here. Okay? And the other thing I want to point out is that, of course, there are measurements of the VH channel. And these all concentrate on looking for some sort of a W prime, a resonant particle in this channel, and these are the limits that you get by looking at these spectra. However, there is no measurement of the scattering angle. And the scenario that I just described is exactly a region where you won't get good signals in the invariant mass spectrum, but you will get a clear signal in the scattering angle. Okay? Okay, so let me skip some of this. Okay, so what are the takeaways from this talk? To phenomenologists, what I would like to say is that there is a lot of physics to do in scattering angles. There is a lot of model building that could be done that could be probed with scattering angles. Okay, especially if new physics is not resonant, there is a very good chance that you could catch them in scattering angles and not in kinematic spectra. And one particular particularly motivated scenario is when you have a resonance that is either kinematically inaccessible in a given search channel, or even if it does not give you good enough signal acceptance. Remember that your particle is always going, or your set of particles is always going to modify a matrix element of yet another channel. So you should always try to look for indirect limits of other channels. Okay. And in particular, if you modify the matrix element this way, you should be able to, result in a very different partition of events in real space, and that should be picked up in scattering angle measurements at colliders. Okay? So what are some examples of this we've seen? If I have a hidden sector that couples to fermions through renormalizable couplings in such a way that it gives you a modification to the matrix element through a T-channel, you should see it in scattering angles, and the case in point is leptoquarks, which clearly do better than dedicated searches at high leptoquark masses. Or if I have a hidden sector that couples to the standard model such that it produces radiative corrections, visible radiative corrections, then threshold effects are inevitable, and that should give you constraints. That should immediately give you constraints. And a well-motivated scenario is dark matter and mediators in a simplified model, which you can discover through interference effects, exactly where the missing energy signals will not get you dark matter. And that should all, by studying the spectra, you should also be able to tell the quantum properties of this hidden sector. Okay? And of course, I can have a new physics scale that couples to the Strand model such that it gives you non-trivial flavor structures. You may not be able to produce the particles of this new physics, but then it could strengthen some already existing channels in the Strand model that are supposed to be weak, right? And an example of this is you can probe the light quark U covers of the Higgs, and you can establish to some extent what they should be using the Higgs-Stalum scattering angle. To experimentalists, what I have to say is, please always measure the scattering angles, regardless of whether you see a bump or not. Scattering angles, the information that you get from scattering angles can already be enough to find the first hints of new physics. And even in channels where scattering angles are measured, the interpretations given to them are usually not more than resonances and contact interactions, but there are a lot more dynamical interpretations that you can give from well-motivated new physics scenarios. So that concludes my talk. Thanks.
Any questions for you?
Yes.
So the sensitivity plots that you show for
yes.
the dielectron invariant mass and the EQ to EQ low energy measurement.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
Are the signals for that generated only with macro, or have you run it through Pythia or something? Showering in hybridization.
Yeah, so, EQ, so which one do you mean? EQ to EQ is just atomic parity violation, right? It's,
yeah, so for the leftover quarks, any of the channels that you can.
Yeah, so for this, you don't need hadronization. This is just low energy operators.
But
you probably mean this.
Right, that.
Right. The simple answer is no. I took the exclusion limits provided by the papers and found the K factors by basically taking my mat graph results and using their backgrounds and basically rescaled everything. If I remember right, the hadronization effect should not give you more than a 10% effect in this case, right? For one jet.
I have one question. Have you come across a case yet where there's some angular spectrum that they're not giving you that they need to be giving you at the LHC?
Yeah, all the dipoles on.
Those dipoles aren't
measured. Exactly.
Let's hang around.